I'm calling this session of the House General Government Committee this morning into session. Welcome, everyone. Committee members, we have some bills to hear, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2188 and invite Pat Allen to come forward and kind of give us... do you want to give an overview first, Committee Administrator?
I'd be happy to.
While he's coming forward?
Very quickly, and I know Pat's going to address these issues more clearly, but House Bill 2188 increases the utilization of advisory committees in the rulemaking process. It enhances quality, timeliness, and impact of fiscal impact statements, and provides opportunities for agencies to waive rules when appropriate. It further establishes the Office of Regulatory Streamlining within the Department of Consumer and Business Services and specifies the duties of that office.
Thank you. Mr. Allen?
Thank you, Chair Berger, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I'd like to provide you today an overview of this bill, kind of a section by section. Here's what it does. The bill represents the legislative recommendations of the Advisory Committee on Agency Rules Streamlining. I provided you a copy of that report in our overview session previously. House Bill 3120 in the 2003 session created the Advisory Committee for the purpose of examining agency rules and the rulemaking process and advising on streamlining. Corey Streisinger, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, was charged by that statute with appointing the members of the advisory committee and chairing, although she did not have a vote. 10 members then were appointed who were drawn from local government agencies and citizen representatives with trying to assemble a wide range of perspectives, consumer interests, environmental interests, interests of those who need to comply with regulations. The committee made a number of recommendations in its report. I think, as we talked about before, most of those were recommendations to agencies and to state government managers about how to more effectively use existing processes. The portions of the recommendations that are legislative are what you find here in 2188. Before reviewing what the bill does, I thought it might be useful to just kind of do a very brief overview of how the administrative rule process works, and what it is that agencies do right now under current state law. There are a number of ways the need for an administrative rule can come up, including you, the legislature, directing an agency to write rules. Stakeholders come forward identifying some kind of an issue they want dealt with or identification by agency staff itself. After some kind of an initial assessment, the nature of which varies a lot from agency to agency and topic to topic, even within an agency, there will be a determination that there's a reason to proceed with the development of a rule. At this point, the agency will also usually determine whether or not they want to use an advisory committee in that rulemaking process. Whether a rule is developed by participation with an advisory committee or directly by agency staff, a point's reached where the agency needs to decide whether to proceed with rulemaking. If the answer is yes, the agency finalizes a draft of a proposed rule and issues public notice, and this is a lot of the area that this bill deals with. Public notice has some mandatory components. There's a statement of need and fiscal impact, which provides a general statement of the objectives of the rule, a citation of the laws being implemented and or the laws authorizing the rule, an analysis of the economic impact on all parties, and this is often a point of confusion. During the legislative session, agencies do a fiscal impact statement on bills, which by law only looks at the fiscal impact on state government. In the administrative rule writing process, agencies are directed to do a fiscal and economic impact on everybody, state government, local government, the public, and then the public includes business impacts. And it's supposed to, that statement of fiscal impact is supposed to capture both positive and negative fiscal impacts. However, agencies aren't required to go out and do original research. They're supposed to use information that's available. And so an okay answer in that fiscal impact process is to say, we don't know what the fiscal impact would be, and here's why, because information is not available, we don't have access to data, those kinds of things. And then finally, the notice includes other information, including the documents that they were relied on, notice of any kind of public hearing that may occur, and more. The purpose of the notice is to alert the public that a rule is being considered and to give meaningful notice to those who may have an interest in that rule, that they've got an interest at stake. So knowing what the topic is, what's being considered, and what the economic impacts may be is intended for people to know, gee, I should get engaged in this issue. and participate. At least that's ostensibly how it should work. The notice is filed with the Secretary of State, published online, and also through the monthly Oregon Bulletin. It's also often posted to an agency's website. Other kinds of communication means an agency may choose to use. Notice is also provided directly to the legislature. After a comment period, and often but not always after a public hearing, the agency then takes some kind of action. They may adopt the rule, they may decide not to adopt the rule, they may send it back for more work, those kinds of things. That's in a very, very brief nutshell, and we can go into more detail if you like. In a very brief nutshell, that's some of the major high points of how the administrative rule process works and the areas that this bill considers for change. So what I'd like to do is give you sort of a quick section by section. Here's how the bill then impacts that system. Section 1, the intent is to increase the incentive for agencies to use advisory committees. Current statute encourages it, but does not require agencies to use advisory committees. And in many cases, it's just not appropriate. Rules that are technical issues, rules where there's something that's been very narrowly legislatively directed, go do a rule that does this in these ways. It's not a universally applicable tool. But there is an intent to try to encourage more use of it in those cases where it is appropriate. An additional purpose is to improve the quality of the fiscal and economic impact statements in administrative rulemaking process. What this section then does to achieve those two goals is that it requires any advisory committee that's used by an agency to provide input on the fiscal and economic impact statement. That's not statutorily now part of what advisory committees do. If an agency uses an advisory committee, then there's no further impact. However, if an agency chooses not to use an advisory committee, decides that for whatever reason they're able to simply proceed with rule development and drafting on their own, it does provide the opportunity where 10 individuals or an association representing 10 or more people can object to the fiscal impact statement and basically cause that work to be done again, to call together a group of people to look at the fiscal and economic impacts. Basically, if that happens, then what happens is there's an extension of the notice period so that the development can be done or work can be done on whatever amendments need to be made to the fiscal, and then the public has more time to look at that revised fiscal and then engage in the rulemaking process if they choose. And again, agencies are able to entirely avoid that loop if in the first place they use an advisory committee. Section 2 of the bill is intended to provide an opportunity for stakeholders in a rulemaking process to get a more detailed explanation of the agency's objective than is provided in the existing statement of need. It would provide stakeholders a better opportunity to suggest appropriate, less burdensome alternatives to proposed regulations, and then requires agencies to document and respond to suggestions that are alternatives that have been proposed. The bill does it by providing a mechanism by which a small number of individuals, 5 in the bill language, can request a statement of objectives from the agency, which is basically a clearer, what is it you're trying to get at and how will you measure whether you're effective at that. By adding a requirement that the record of the rulemaking must include any agency response to such a request, and by adding a requirement that the record include any alternative means of compliance proposed to the agency and the agency's response to those suggestions. Section 3 is a little unusual. There are basically parallel sections of this statute because there's a new version that takes effect during the biennium. So Section 3 is simply a repeat of Section 2, but it applies to the parallel language. It doesn't do anything different than Section 2. Section 4 of the bill is probably the most was the bill that the part of the recommendations that the committee spent, I'd say, the most time trying to figure out how to get to. The purpose of the section is to provide agencies the opportunity to grant waivers of administrative rules where the result of literal application of the rule provides an outcome that's contrary to public policy. The way the bill does that in Section 4 is that if agencies choose to use this tool to provide waivers, they need to adopt a waiver rule outlining how they'll consider waivers. They can only be granted when consistent with the objectives of the rule and the underlying statute, and when the application of the rule would result in an absurd or undesirable result, or the cost of compliance with the rule is greater than the normal cost of compliance. or greater than the cost that was anticipated. And then the final point is that denial of a waiver can only be appealed to the courts, and then only for process defects. The intent is to not add a whole nother loop of administrative process, but to provide an opportunity for now. Let me illustrate the circumstance with a fairly prosaic example. In my spare time for fun, I serve on the City of Sherwood Planning Commission. And a while back, we were looking at codes dealing with retaining walls and codes dealing with fences. And there were maximum heights in both. And we started seeing some development on some hillsides and realized that the literal application of the code could put a maximum fence on top of a maximum wall and have the Berlin Wall in someone's backyard. And everybody decided that was a bad thing. So we started writing some regulations to try to deal with that. But you started looking at different parts of town and places where property lines ran one direction and topographical lines went another, and you realize, gee, the way we've drafted this could end up with some really silly results if literally applied. So then we started trying to write even more detail into the code to figure out how to deal with those circumstances, and you ended up with a couple of things really quickly. One was that the code gets more and more complicated the more you think about all the possible outcomes that could come up, and no matter how complicated the code gets, you'll forget something. And something will come up where no matter how detailed you've gotten, the literal application ends up with a result that just doesn't make sense given what you were trying to do. And so what we worked on in that section of code was the ability to say, here's the intent. Here's what this code is supposed to do. Here are the rules. But the planning director's got the ability to approve alternatives if they're consistent with what we're trying to achieve, which is not having big, huge walls in people's backyards. Finally, Section 6, just very briefly, it makes the Office of Regulatory Streamlining a statutory entity within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is not something that my office advocated for as a recommendation of the committee, and we're effectively neutral on that portion of this bill. We support the rest of the changes to the administrative rule process, and I think members of the committee may speak to that issue of making the office permanent. I know that's a really fast overview of what's in this bill, and if it pleases the chair, after I'm done, three members of the committee are prepared to come and provide a little more color to the discussions the committee went through, Luis Soliday, Stephanie Halleck, and Tom Gallagher. I should point out, although it's mentioned in the report, Luis Soliday, when she was appointed to the advisory committee, was a citizen member and was there representing herself and continues to do so today, although now she works in the governor's natural resource office. So I just want to make sure people weren't confused about that linkage. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
The panel, unless there's some burning question, I'd like to bring the panel, Tom Gallagher, Louise Soliday, and Stephanie Halleck up as a panel, and Pat, you're going to stay in the room for further questions and let them organize themselves for further testimony, and then we'll entertain whatever questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, streamline.
Good Lord. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Gallagher, Stephanie Halleck, Director of DEQ, and Louise Soliday in the Governor's Office. And when they do their speech, I'm sure they'll reintroduce themselves. But we were all on a pretty wonderful work group. This is the Uniform Rules of Procedure under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is what we were working out of. I noticed it has a tennis shoe footmark on it. I remember the day that I kicked this book across the room. It was fairly frustrating. When we did the overview of regulatory streamlining, you were handed out a sheet called Factors the Agency Shall Weigh When Evaluating the Need for and or Effect of a Rule. That's in this manual. It was drafted by two of the agency directors are on the committee, and it's extremely helpful, I think, for agencies. One of the things in the experience we had in the committee was that there were some agencies that had made adjustments into a new way of writing rules faster than others. So we always had examples as people would come in, of people would say, well, we're already doing it the way that's outlined in 2188, or other agencies would say, well, here's the reason we don't do that. So we listened to a lot of different testimony from agencies. Pat did a good overview of the way the bill works. On the little handout that I gave you, I list the general sections of the rule that we were working in 183, and if you'll notice under 333 and 335, that's where the pieces that we ended up doing got put into 183. 183 is really written around the legal and judicial process of public notice and how the rule is defended and sustained and what needs to go in the rule, and it's quite, in a sense, legalistic. And as everybody came in and started sticking these regulatory streamlining ideas, the Legislative Council put them in 183. So 183 is a whole bunch of chapter outlines of technical process, and then inside of each of those are little nuggets of information. If you turn to the second page of what I gave you, I kind of tried to walk through what we were trying to accomplish, and I don't think it's proper to use the term "here it is" in plain English anymore, but here it is in human being speak. Part of what we wanted to do was get the agencies and the interested parties, that includes the folks who are public interest groups as well as the regulated community, really engaged in a dialogue on the idea of the rule. Usually in the past, in the old days, an agency would draft the rule, publish it, and then everybody would go in and attack the rule that they drafted. And over the years, we've started to do more of these group assignments where the rule kind of gets drafted and redrafted out of this collective process. And we think that's good. But it's pretty hard under the notice provision to say, okay, when the agency dreams up some idea, they should collect a few people together, because all of a sudden you start violating notice and other public interest things and so forth. So we tried to marry the two ideas together. So the agency may start with just a concept, or they may start even with a draft rule. But the idea is to get this broad-based advisory committee together and start looking at how it's actually going to work. That brought us to number two or three here, which is four, where at some point in time, and there is language to this effect already in the statute, that people ought to identify what it is they're trying to accomplish. And let's just use Pat's idea of the fences. Look, we want to have fences of reasonable height so people can see in the yard, so people aren't walled in and they don't need a moat and a drawbridge and so forth. That's not the way we want our communities to look. So you outline what it is you're trying to accomplish with the fence ordinance, and you say, now this is the way we're going to not measure the outcomes, because that's too technical, but this is the way we're going to see if it works. And the way Pat's folks did it was they gave a lot of authority to the agency planning director, and then they can go back and review all the permits that he gives and say, did we achieve what we meant to achieve here? Now, it's a little difficult, in my view, to actually do what I'm talking about in exchange of drafts of the rules. You know, you don't quite have the same kind of dialogue. You don't quite all get on the same page. Well, we had a really good example of this in DEQ when we were talking about converting the underground storage tank program from the old command and control, clean up the tanks, check it, to a training program and an oversight program that was of real assistance to the actual gas station owners. And that committee was an actual example of this, where the staff people from DEQ and the agencies, the dealers and the jobbers and the major oil companies, actually came in with different ideas as to how they could do the education programs, who could run them, which ones were good, which ones were bad. So that's what we're trying to get at. I pushed a little further, and it didn't make it in here, that actually the interest groups could sort of rewrite the rule to achieve the same outcomes, and then the agency would have to prove that the rewrite wasn't right. Well, I went a little too far. But a piece of that gets picked up in there where it says the agency has to respond to comments. So if you really have some interest groups or some regulated parties that are into this, and they say, if you write this rule this way, you are going to have fences on the side of a hill that look like they're only 4 feet tall, not 6 feet tall, because of the topography of the land, and don't do any good at all, and you're going to have other fences that are way too high for the topography of the land, and we don't think your rule will work, agency, and here's our idea, then the agency will respond to say why that idea doesn't work, so you have a record. So everybody can come back in the outcome part and say, aha, we told you so, the agency was right, or whatever. I'll just quickly add the last two pieces. The idea of saying that you don't have to apply a rule when it's absurd really led into a complicated debate about what agency would ever want to do that. what agency would ever want to step out and say, okay, you don't have to follow this rule? Somebody's going to get mad about it. Somebody else is going to come in later on and say, well, I match that. I'm just like that other waiver that you granted, or I'm close. Why don't you waive it for me? And then the agency is going to spend the next 16 years of its life defining how many angels can dance on the head of a waiver pin. So they may have a different idea. I really thought the idea was a good one to start with. I sort of came down to the conclusion, let's see how that works. I mean, we may be back here with nobody ever having granted a waiver in 2 years. We may be back here with a lot of rules reading like Pat's draft did. And we may be back here with a lot of agency discretion and a lot of parties that are happy and some really disgruntled parties. So I can imagine in 2 years from now you can have some bill drafts from one group of people saying it didn't work and another group of people saying it did. The last piece is putting this regulatory streamlining department, which is set up by a governor's order, into statute. And I want to go further, and I'm going to advocate in ways and means that they actually add another body to that office. And that body will be dedicated to small business. There really, in most of these rules, is not a well-funded, well-organized interest group like the home builders or environmental regulatory groups that have groups of lawyers that follow this, or the AOI, or a union, or whatever organized group it is. Most of these small businesses don't have that. They belong to the restaurant association, they're lucky, but if they're just, you know, mom-and-pop hardware stores, they don't have that. And my idea for adding that body would be not as somebody you'd call up, like an ombudsperson, and get them to come in and represent you against the agency at all. It would be somebody inside of government that was an advisor, a trainer, a help to agency that collected all of the mistakes that you could make about small agencies and would go to those agencies that were writing the rule and say, you know, you're just in this one little area. Let me shine some light on some outcomes that have happened from other people, other effects on small business, and let me help you look at how you can kind of redraft that so it'll have less of an impact. And maybe even to some extent, the small businesses will do this on the fiscal advisory committees. They'll come in and say, the way you're going to do this is really burdensome to us. I mean, you're asking to collect a whole other set of information we give to a second agency. Why don't you go get it from them? Or maybe that small business advocate could help the agency on the rule and it wouldn't end up that far down the road. So I'm very supportive of this. I think 2188 is going to work fairly well, and really enjoyed working with the two people that are on my left.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality and was a member of this advisory committee, and also I'm here to speak in support of the bill. I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of the relationship of this bill to what we do. First of all, as Tom pointed out in the Administrative Procedures Manual, we were one of the agencies who participated in creating the rule factors to help guide how agencies should think about rule writing and the impact of the rules we make. So we participated in that way. We, as you may know, are governed by a commission, the Environmental Quality Commission, whose members are appointed by the governor. And our rulemaking at DEQ, all rules must be approved by that commission. I have no unilateral rulemaking authority as the director. So we already have built into our processes a lot of public participation just by nature of how our rules are adopted. And we, as an agency, I've been there for 16 years, and as long as I've been at the agency, we have made extensive use of advisory committees. So the requirement in the bill to use an advisory committee will not be anything new for us. What I think will be an added benefit for us is the focus on the fiscal impact statements. We are also required to do those, as was mentioned by Pat and Tom, but this will give an opportunity for our advisory committees that we already use to have a more in-depth discussion of precisely of the fiscal impact. So we think that's a good addition to the process. With regard to the rule waivers, that again, we do have some authorities. We do a lot of programs at DEQ that are delegated to us by the federal government, so there will be some restrictions on what we are able to waive and what we are not able to waive. And we do already, in some of our laws, have ability to waive some requirements. And, of course, any rule that we would adopt to take on initial additional ability to waive, we would have to take to our Environmental Quality Commission and get their approval and probably discuss whether or not they would need to be involved in that process. So for us, it will be, of course, a balance on any waiver of our responsibility to allow public participation and also to move a process forward efficiently, and that is the kind of balance we always have to be concerned about as an agency. But in general, I think that these provisions in the bill should help improve some of the processes, and so we're in support of it.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Louise Soliday. I'm wearing my general citizen hat today, not my governor's office hat, and I just wanted to make that clear. I want to speak a little more to the waiver provision because I suspect that's the one that will raise the most concerns or folks will have issues with. And I think it's important to point out that the subcommittee who worked on the drafting of these recommendations spent a lot of time talking about this particular issue and how to craft it in a way that was narrow but still achieved the objective of giving the ability to agencies to waive rules when you were going to have these absurd or unintended consequences. And as Pat and Tom have pointed out, you can't anticipate all the scenarios that are going to happen when you're going through a rulemaking process. And so having the ability of the agencies to, at their discretion, provide for waiver of rules seemed to make a lot of sense to the folks who were on the committee. And I think it's narrowly crafted. It can only be used in certain circumstances. It's not appealable in terms of the substance it is in terms of the procedural issues. And I think hopefully that will give folks comfort who are concerned about this particular provision that it is narrowly crafted. And we'll see what happens over the next couple of years should this become law. There are agencies who already have waiver authority in their rules in certain circumstances, and it is used occasionally. It's not something that's used on a regular basis, but it does happen occasionally. And I think we'll probably find the same sort of track record with this provision as we find with the provisions that are already in existing rules and in agency rules. So we'll see where we end up here on the bill, but I just wanted to reinforce that it is narrowly crafted, and I think it'll be a useful tool in certain circumstances for agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher.
I would, if this bill should pass and become law, I think we should all take some sort of notice of the fact we'd be the first group of people to put the word absurd in the Oregon statutes.
I have to ask, Mr. Gallagher, have you read all Oregon statutes? Are you absolutely sure that word is not in there somewhere?
No, but my partner Mike Dewey has.
Okay, I will. Thank you all for coming. I have a question, and then I will invite questions from the committee. We're stepping off a little bit into uncharted waters with this in terms of Oregon agencies, and you spoke, Tom, to wanting to strengthen this as an agency itself, regulatory streamlining. Is there a sense that then as we, in the next 2 years, were we to pass this, to step out there, they would be the ones that would monitor how we're doing in this uncharted waters? Do you understand the question?
Madam Chair, right now they have Pat Allen, and to a large extent, when you have a section or a group with one person in it, it's results depend an awful lot on the quality of that person. It's not an organization. Even if we were successful in this budgetary time of getting two people there. There's a limited amount they can do. But in one sense, they will be there. They will always be there. And if the people that are in that department and the director of that department plays that instrument well, they will find the right place to be at the right time. They won't be trying to cover all of the rules that go through the process. They will be looking at the agencies that need some education and some help because there's some friction that goes on in their rule process. They will be looking at types of rules. They will learn how to focus on the right part of the project. A large part of the discussion, I think, that went on in the group about the Office of Regulatory Streamlining was the use of the words training and sharing. And again, I'll go back to our overview where we talked about there's no substitute for good management. So this office will be a tool for managers, kind of an outside their agency, a tool that good managers will draw on and take advice from, that may be getting involved in more training of agency rule writers. So just to give you an example, the state of New York, where Chandler and I first looked at this, has an entire department of regulatory streamlining. 6,243 people reviewing 197,000 people, whatever their numbers are in New York. That's not where we want to go. We want to go here with a guided hand, a light hand. This administration, in its executive orders and its directions to regulatory streamlining, has started the process without starting a revolution, and this is an evolutionary process.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Anyone on the panel, just some comments first. There's much I like in this bill, including the requirement for a response to input on the rulemaking, to have that as something that's specifically required. I have a question about the makeup of the advisory committee. Is this chosen? Is there a set number? Is this left to the discretion of the agency director, six people, seven people? And along with that, is there any thought given to reconvening the advisory committee after 2 years or 3 years in order to check to see how the rule is actually working for the stakeholders?
I can, Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, Stephanie Halleck, for the record, I'll take a crack at this. Pat Allen may want to comment. The bill, Section 1 of the bill simply says the agency may appoint an advisory committee that will represent the interests of persons likely to be affected by the rule or use any, or use any other means of obtaining public views that will assist the agency in drafting the rule. As a matter of practice, I can tell you, when we do our advisory committees, which we have been doing for quite some time, we have an example that actually will be discussed this session. We appointed an advisory committee for a wastewater permitting program. I think we had 20-some representatives on there, and we had members of environmental groups, members of municipal government, food processing industry, Associated Oregon Industries. We had just the broad spectrum of folks represented who would be affected by our wastewater permitting program. So we've always cast a wide net. I think the intent is to cast a wide net to be sure you bring in people who will be affected, because the bill also then allows folks who were not happy with how this went to speak back to the agency and say, you need to look at this again. So that would be my answer. I don't know whether Tom or Pat want to comment any more about their thoughts for these advisory committees.
Madam Chair, Tom Gallagher, I take you back to the principles in the 3120 report. Good management and will never make everybody happy.
Right.
So how that gets translated back to you folks as legislators and to other people about, oh, that advisory committee was horrible. I can remember advisory committee I sat on where I thought I was the token tackling dummy and everybody went at me. I sat on other advisory committees where I thought finally my genius is recognized. And I think that's up to the individual of people on the committees. And the good agencies, the good management agencies, will have the right people in the room to duke it out. If you go back to the bigger picture of where public input occurs, and as you get from the rulemaking down toward the project, the more of the They have the problems of the public that are resolved in the rulemaking. The more those debates are satisfied and settled satisfactory, the less there will be on the permit end. And the last thing I'll add is one of my goals, and some of the other people like J.L. Wilson from NFIB who are on this committee and some private sector business people, was the regulated community has to take more responsibility. They have to get in and help make the rule work, not just complain about it, not just look at it that way. And if we've done anything, if we've tilted more responsibility onto the regulatory community to participate and to participate intelligently and thoroughly at the beginning of the process, then we've done some good.
To follow?
Yes.
I don't see a need that this would have to actually be part of the bill itself, but it would be good management. But to do a check-in with the advisory group 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, to see how the rule is working for the stakeholders.
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, if you look at the section, and I'm not going to be able to pull it out of my head, Patkin, that sets out that I think it's in 335 sub D, but it's where it talks about outcomes, mm-hmm. and whether or not those outcomes are achieved. Again, my point would be rather than actually getting the advisory committee back together, if the management says it's not working right, we're going to need to revise the rule, back comes the advisory committee. If people who are there can come back and go to the director, they can initiate rulemaking on their own in most places. So there are already built-in feedback. And my feeling here is let's see how much responsibility the regulatory community takes on as opposed to, and one of the things we're trying to avoid is putting things in the statute that are only necessary in the exception times, but now become the responsibility for everybody all the time. Mm-hmm. So I got a real, it's working real well. I got an advisory committee, but the law says I got to reconvene them in 2 years to look at it.
Okay.
All right, so I got a lot of effort going on, and they're going to call me up and say, no, I'm too busy to come to that. I got, you know, I'm going to play golf. So the details in the good management.
Gotcha. Just one last comment. I do look forward to the discussions 2 years from now on the definition of absurdity. That will be a highlight, I'm sure.
Further questions of this panel? Thank you very much for coming. Thank you also for the work you are continuing to do in this arena. I'd like to ask Len Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association to come forward and comment on this.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'll be rather brief. I just have a few concerns that I thought might have been answered as I listened this morning to the early testimony. I didn't hear it, but I always have to look at any piece of legislation and wonder what's the need, what's the real need for this bill, and then who's pushing for the bill. And I kind of got a sense of it, but I don't know if I'm totally satisfied. So I have to then look at the words of it a little more, with a little more scrutiny. And you asked part of the question about who gets appointed to these advisory committees. I think oftentimes, or at least in a recent example that I've seen, a commission that would use an advisory committee, the advisory committee would come together with a plan, and here's the plan, and then it's about to become rule, the plan, which is law that we have to live with. And then the advisory committee, or the commission, excuse me, can say, well, you know, the advisory committee, this is what they wanted us to do. Unless there's some reason to change it, I guess we'll just put our stamp on it. I think at some time might be a way for them to take some of the heat off of themselves, because otherwise a commission, who is a citizenry body appointed, take phone calls from people like me saying, did you know that this rule that you're about to adopt is blah, 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 blah? Well, they can kind of say, don't call me, call that advisory committee or go testify to them. The other thing that I have a concern about in this advisory committee, and in a sense back to the concern of who gets appointed, is that, well, for example, if a rule is going to be affecting mostly rural communities, but where are these meetings usually held, and where are the center, the hubs of where the people are that are willing to serve are usually in the Salem or the Portland area. And this is a wolf plan, by the way, that I held up. And even in the wolf plan, they expect that wolves will come from Idaho and they'll probably start in northeastern Oregon. Okay? Well, the representative for the Livestock Association and the county commissioner from that area wrote minority reports to this rule because they are the ones who are going to be affected most, with the most impact and first. But that didn't change anything. They're still probably on the tracks to be accepted as law shortly. And so I have some concerns about this. I'm not sure that there would be any tremendous bad effects if this were to pass. It might be interesting to see. Maybe part of my concerns would be answered if this were done for a couple years, and we'll see who starts popping up. But then you have the problem is, how do you undo this? I don't really see a sunset in here that says this goes away after 2 years unless you readopt it. Because I know how easy it is to stop law to start with, but I know how hard it is to change law once it is law. So I have those concerns. I don't know if you have those concerns, but I would at least like to plant a few seeds and be happy to answer any questions. And thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
And we appreciate you bringing forward this perspective, because I think we are kind of stepping out a little bit out of conventional boundaries.
Thank you.
Thank you. There being no further testimony or questions or comments from the committee on this particular proposal, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2188 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2204.
Yes,
Madam Administrator. And while she's preparing her notes, I am going to inform the committee and those in the room that I am going to be testifying shortly in a hearing next door, and we'll be passing the gavel probably in the middle of this testimony. So if I get up and walk out, forgive me.
Go ahead, Kara. Thank you. House Bill 2204 allows state agencies to notify parties interested in rulemaking via email. It requires interested parties to provide a mailing address or electronic address to the agency if they desire to be notified. It, in effect, moves our notification of rulemaking into the 21st century.
Thank you. I'd like to call Philip Schradel from the AG's office to come and talk about it. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Berger, members of the committee. Philip Schradel, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The two bills, 2204, which is the bill currently being heard, and 2206, are really, they were ideas that came out of our Law Improvement Steering Committee process over in the Department of Justice, but we thought they aligned very closely with the goals of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, and the AG's office and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining are jointly sponsoring these bills. This bill really does, as your administrator said, kind of bring the rulemaking process up into the 21st century. The goal here is simply to allow notice of rulemaking proceedings to be provided through electronic mail. And that currently isn't authorized expressly in statute, and this simply does a couple of tweaks to the notice of rulemaking statutes to allow that to occur. Doesn't compel somebody to provide an electronic mailing address, but authorizes the agency to request either a mailing address or an electronic mailing address and then provide notice accordingly. It seems to be, a good government viewpoint that should hopefully help streamline the process and save money and time.
Questions?
I just want to thank you for including your email address on your testimony.
I have a little bit of a question.
Certainly.
I always worry about something like this. A few folks got together. It made sense to them. Let's do it.
Who else have you reached out to in terms of this, besides a few folks got together, makes sense?
Chair Berger, actually there was not a tremendous amount of outreach done, and in part because it doesn't compel anything in particular at all. The idea here is simply that, you know, agencies, if somebody expresses interest in receiving notice, can ask the person either to provide a mailing address or an electronic mailing address. If the person doesn't want to, you know, provide or doesn't have electronic mailing address, then certainly, you know, nothing further than as currently the situation would occur. So we thought that there really, it's only a benefit, there's no harm associated with it, but that's the purpose.
And that being said, there's a clear understanding that nowhere in this are we going to say to people, oh, you can't have this information if you don't have an electronic address.
Chair Berger, that's certainly not the intent at all, and nothing in here would accomplish that.
Thank you. Further questions?
Sir, in reading your recap here, I'm wondering, is there a person or any group of persons under any condition who is not authorized to receive email on these issues?
Chair Berger, Representative Sumner, I'm not aware. I mean, in terms of practical terms, whether there might be somebody out there who cannot receive electronic mailing, or if they don't have the ability, the facility to do that, of course. In terms of any kind of legal impediments to providing notice by electronic mailing, I'm unaware of that. I don't think there would be any prohibitions against using that.
So to paraphrase that, if a convicted murderer in prison wants to be told of and kept up with these things, he's qualified to receive that message.
Chair Berger,
if he has email.
Yes, that's correct. And currently, that person would be able to receive notice by requesting notice anyway through regular mail.
Okay.
Further questions? This particular bill? You may stay in the chair, sir, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2204 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2206 and again invite you, Mr. Schradl, to speak.
I'm Chair Berger, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, Special Counsel for the Attorney General. I'm not sure whether you wanted to have the administrator give a brief overview. I'd be happy to.
Sure.
Thank you. House Bill 2206 amends current law on how administrative rule changes are formatted. It allows copies of an amended rule to indicate changes by striking through material to be deleted and underlining new material or by any other method that clearly shows new and deleted material. And this, again, is one of those move to the 21st century so that software matches our ability to and how law dictates that these changes be noted.
Thank you. I apologize. Mr. Schradl.
Chair Berger and members of the committee. Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The goal here, again, is to make this an easier process. Right now, we're required by statute to almost, there are two different statutory provisions that govern both for providing the notice at the beginning and then providing notice to legislative council after a rule has been adopted. Those have slightly different statutory provisions that apply to them. This would eliminate any confusion about that. But more importantly, it would make the ability for state agencies to use simply software that's out there in the public domain and is easy to use, which simply uses strike-through and underlining for strike-through for omitting language that currently exists and then underlining for highlighting new language that's being amended into the rules. This is simply a cost-saving mechanism. I've talked with Legislative Counsel Dave Hendricks. They're comfortable with receiving the notice after the rule has been adopted in this format, as long as it's done in a way that clearly shows what is being omitted, what is being added. And this is simply a convenience and an administrative function that would serve, I think, everybody's interest very well. We think it also would eliminate some confusion on people reading administrative rules. As legislators, I think you're very familiar with the bracketing and italics for omissions and bolding for new language. That bracketing and italics is sometimes a little bit hieroglyphic for people who aren't familiar with that kind of a process. And this would simplify that process. and we think it would just be easier for those people, lay people out there who are getting notice of rules, to understand what is being accomplished, as well as making it just more a facile and easy process to for agencies to comply with and for legislative council to accept the rules.
Thank you. I have a specific question here. We've just spent an awful lot of time talking about how we can unrule ourselves, and I'm a little concerned as to why this has to be statutory in the sense of a laying out exactly how you're going to do this. Why can't this be just, this is, you know, agencies, this is accepted practice or something? Why do we have to write this in statute? What's accomplished here?
Well, Chair Berger, that's a good question, because at least with respect to legislative council, they can, by agreement, agree to accept it in any form currently under statute. But with respect to the notice that needs to be provided out to the public, it currently provides that it needs to be shown by bracketing material to be deleted and showing all new material in boldface type.
That is correct.
There's already that kind of language in the statute, so this is simply changing that statutory language. It's not adding a new, something that doesn't exist in statute already. It is simply changing that. And then the piece with legislative counsel, actually, is a bit redundant because it already provides for legislative council to accept anything in any form that they're comfortable with, but it seemed to be that the statutes would be most easily read if they were consistent. So.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Trail. No one else wants to speak on this at this time, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2206. And I didn't have to leave. Thank you all. Just a warning, we're going to start with some work sessions next week. We're also going to hear from Mr. Corey Streisinger. And thank you for coming. So I'm going to adjourn today's